I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Thomas Jefferson is our guest this hour. Maybe the greatest political mind in American history. Probably the most learned, the most inventive, probably the figure we'd most love to have around today. Franklin Delano Roosevelt called Jefferson an apostle of freedom. The historian Joseph Ellis calls him the great sphinx of American history, the enigmatic and elusive touchstone for the most cherished convictions and contested truths in American culture. Jefferson was very nearly all things to all men, even before his death on July 4, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration. He was a national icon. He seemed to transcend all parties and all conflicts. In his retirement, Jefferson answered more than 1,000 letters a year, letters mostly from strangers, and he functioned as the proprietor of his home at Monticello, which ran something like a hotel. Connection listeners, imagine he is here today. Our guest Clay Jenkinson is a modern incarnation of Thomas Jefferson. He's a Jefferson scholar. He does Jefferson on public radio. Would you care to know Thomas Jefferson's views on affirmative action, on abortion, on slavery and its abolition, on taxes, on the environment, on what happened to the Louisiana Purchase, on foreign policy? Would you care to get his commentary about his time and maybe about ours? 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK makes the connection this hour with Thomas Jefferson. Welcome, Mr. Jefferson, Mr. Jenkinson, as you like. First question from a Boston slant. John Hancock got the big signature on the Declaration. You get the great share of the credit for not only the prose but the ideas. What's the truth of the matter in the heroism and the standing among the founding fathers?
Hancock doesn't play much of a role amongst the founding fathers. He was the president of the Congress, and he signed boldly and immediately. The Declaration was promulgated on the 4th of July, 1776, but not signed until a few weeks later. The engrossed copy, the calligraphy copy, had to be made by a craftsman. But at any rate, I was not known as the principal author of the Declaration for about 25 years. It was seen as a committee work. But the ideas I cannot claim to be mine. They were commonplace ideas of the Enlightenment. What I did, which I suppose gives me a certain measure of greatness, is distill 15 or 20 years of reading in Enlightenment texts into one breathtaking sentence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, but there's not an original thought in that document.
It's nice to hear a man claim his own greatness a couple hundred years later. Among the guys is what I'm wondering. Did you claim preeminence?
Certainly not. George Washington was a much greater man than I. He will be remembered as long as liberty has devotees in the world. And Dr. Franklin, born here, arguably the greatest man of the 18th century on either side of the Atlantic. I would also defer to John Adams, who was 8 years my senior. He was not always a likable man, but he was an extraordinarily important one.
Place yourself, and let me sharpen the question just a little bit. I mean, Jefferson stands for many things, including his rhetoric, as you say, but also for an idea of a nation of yeoman farmers, a nation that would make and preserve a certain kind of citizen as well as citizenship, the small landowner. He didn't want industry. He didn't like what industry did to nations and people. What do you think of as your great legacy, and how's it doing?
Well, I believe in one idea very deeply and very firmly, that under the right circumstances, average human beings can govern themselves. Now, that, I suppose, sounds like a cliche in your time, but it was a fighting concept in my era, and most of the founding fathers, including John Adams, did not believe, frankly, that mankind was capable of self-government. I believe that if we educate people, if we keep them diffused across an agrarian landscape, if we will keep our ears tuned to nature and nature's law, that we can govern ourselves better than any elite that we could possibly imagine. And so my fundamental idea is that we don't require kings, don't require priests, don't require aristocrats and landlords, that simple people, yeoman farmers, can produce something like paradise on earth if they go about it with care.
And yet we're no longer diffused. We're a nation of cities. We don't have an aristocracy, but we do have elites. How are we doing, in short?
Not very well. You have created the most prosperous middle class in human history. You certainly are the most powerful nation on Earth. Whether that's a good thing, I leave to you to determine. And the average American is more secure in his person than anyone who ever walked on Earth. On the other hand, I do believe that cities are cancer sores on the face of the landscape. And I think that you have become dependent as a people. You're dependent for your basic resources. You don't grow your own food. You get your fuel from entities that you cannot control, and so on. You have become dependent, and dependency is a form of slavery. It is what creates tyranny. If you're dependent upon an institution that you can't control, then you no longer are a free agent in the world. So a farmer who feeds himself and clothes himself and shelters himself and gathers his own fuel is more truly independent than any city dweller. You've become Mr. Hamilton's people. You're a mercantilist military empire. When I wanted you to be a quiet, mild-mannered, pastoral nation, I once said, if we could only be a fourth- or fifth-ranked nation like China, then we would have something in America.
And yet we have dealt with real slavery, as you not only tolerated it in the Constitution, but practiced it as an owner yourself.
Indeed.
That's a kind of progress.
I plead guilty. I will say that I consider slavery to be an abomination, unnatural, illegal, outrageous, and my own ownership of slaves is a blot upon my historical reputation, as it should be. But this much I can say. The first draft of the Emancipation Proclamation was the Declaration of Independence. The 16th president rightly understood that the principle that I articulated in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, must now be applied universally, including to Negro Americans.
I wonder how grave is the failure of Jeffersonian America when you speak of a Hamiltonian military empire, not a happily third-rate agrarian society. I mean, a third-rate power. Do you feel defeated?
No, because I believe the earth belongs to the living. The dead have no rights. The dead hand of the past must not be permitted to lord it over unborn generations. Furthermore, I'm a Democrat. I believe the American people have a right to determine their own happiness, and if they choose a means other than the one that I would have suggested, it does me no injury. My own personal utopia would not be an urban one, would not be a military one, would not be a centralized government, would not have a national debt, would not be an interventionist foreign policy, would not have swallowed the states up into what Mr. Hamilton called mere administrative units, and it profoundly would not be a nation of people getting and spending. It would not be a materialist nation, but that's my own vision. But what matters is that the American people are free and therefore can determine their own destiny, and you have chosen emphatically to be the nation that you are. So it does me no personal injury.
You didn't feel there was a guarantee of the success of your experiment, and you're famous even in the 21st century for saying that the tree of liberty, as you imagine liberty, must be refreshed from time to time by the blood of patriots.
And tyrants. not just patriots. Tyrants, too, must bleed.
But this is a favorite line among modern militias, as we call them, meant something different to you. Is it time for another sort of revolution, some sort of uprising in this country or not?
Well, that's for you to determine. I argued that we should tear up the Constitution on principle every 19th year so that each generation could reconfigure the nation according to its dreams and its needs. And I believe that any single Constitution has very limited tenure and should not be allowed to become a kind of sacred, secular document. So I would have torn up the Constitution very often. I certainly would amend the Constitution more often than you have done. Whether it's time now for a revolution, I leave to you to determine, but I will say this, that I am the philosopher of radical change. I prefer peaceful revolution, but I'm not afraid of bloody revolution, and it is right that the militia movement and the radical fringe in your time point to my words, because of all of the founding fathers, I'm the only one who said things like, the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. And to Mr. Madison, I like a little rebellion now and then. It's as important in the political world as thunderstorms are in the natural world.
What would you amend in the Constitution?
Well, I was against a national debt. I think a national debt is a way of taxing our children without their consent. It also creates corruption and heavy government. And so that's some provision that I would have wanted in my own time. And I think it's even more incumbent upon you to have it now. I believe, furthermore, that there should be term limits for all national officers, including members of the judiciary. I don't believe...
Did you pick this up from us, or did you think it all the time?
No, it was my view in my own lifetime. I believe that one term for president of, say, 7 years, with a vote of confidence or no confidence in the middle, and two terms for other national officers, including some sort of plebiscite from time to time on the efficiency of the judiciary. I don't think we should have life tenure and judicial independence.
Thomas Jefferson, it's fair to say you did everything well. I'm thinking of two things in particular. You were a famous architect. I'd like your comment on sort of the look of the United States, the public United States, the highway United States. But you were also a famous farmer, student of your own sort of agricultural biology. I want to know what you make of what we call the Green Revolution. Bioengineering of those seeds that you kept and kept very careful track of. Your comments on architecture and agriculture.
Those are both tall subjects. First of all, let me say that I wouldn't claim to be a true architect. I'm a builder. There were no professional architects in my time, but I did design Monticello and the Rotunda at the University of Virginia and my second home, Poplar Forest, and about 20 private homes and the Capitol at Richmond. What I would say about your public architecture is that I was right when I developed a monumental Roman revival architecture for our public buildings. The Capitol at Richmond is designed after the Maison Carrée in Nîmes, France, and it was the beginning of that classical revival. And virtually all of your state capitals and many of your municipal ones are Greek and Roman in their basic design because of that. I think that's appropriate. Your other public buildings, and certainly your private commercial buildings, I would call open sores on the face of the landscape. I would say your skyscraper, for example, as characterized by Boston, is a triumph of engineering over good sense and symmetry. But again, these are tastes which change from time to time in the course of a nation's destiny. And your private dwellings, it seemed to me, are deplorably utilitarian.
And modern agriculture.
Well, it's agribusiness now, isn't it? There are very few actual farmers. In my time, 90-some percent of the American people were self-sufficient farmers. In your time, fewer than 2% are farmers of any stamp, and most of them not self-sufficient. I would be fascinated, however, by what you're calling the Green Revolution. Hybrid petrochemicals, fertilizers, pesticides, machinery, all of these things would have deeply, deeply fascinated me. We lived in the last medieval age. We were still farming essentially as Homer had farmed in the ancient world. So I had a threshing machine that I obtained from Scotland. I had seed broadcasting devices. I did some minor hybriding and so on with trees, with my orchards at Monticello. But I will tell you this, I would be utterly fascinated by the revolution in agriculture, except in one regard. It appears to have created in its wake gigantism and such a heavy capitalization that it's basically produced Hamilton's agricultural economy, not the self-sufficient yeomanry that I had in mind.
1-800-423-8255 is the Jefferson Connection phone. 1-800-423-TALK. Thomas Jefferson is our guest in the form and voice of the scholar Clay Jenkinson of public radio fame, a Rhodes Scholar who does Thomas Jefferson. 1-800-423-8255. Jefferson on the 18th century, Jefferson on the 21st. 1-800-423-8255 is the phone. Sam is on the line.
Sir, Social Security reform. I wonder where your stand might be on that, given your disdain for indenturing future generations with the debt of present generations. School vouchers, given your belief in the highest attainable high education and also the rights and responsibilities of individuals to control, you know, some portions of their destinies, where would you stand on school vouchers? Number three, and I have four quick questions here. Some form of nationalized health insurance. Where would you stand on that? And finally, I can't help but notice that your accent has evolved a bit over the last 200 years, and I wondered, when, in your younger years, would your accent have been kind of like a modern Central Virginia accent, where my mother's own family was from, or more English?
Thank you.
Sam, thank you.
We go in reverse order. My accent is different, as you rightly point out. It would have been a slight Scots accent, or if you know a cultivated North Carolina or Virginia accent, it would have been something like that. But, of course, there are no recordings of my voice, and I had a slight speech impediment and a high-pitched voice.
I was going to say, your voice has come down a bit.
It has. I could not raise my voice above the level of a whisper in public, and it was so high-pitched that it was grating on people's sensibilities. So I've adjusted it for your modern media somewhat. As to the rest, let me just say I'm against the welfare state in all of its forms. In my time, I would have called this the positive state. But I believe the government should serve as a mere referee. It should solve disputes between Maryland and Virginia. It should create a post office. It should have a foreign policy and a modest defense system. But it should not play any significant positive role in our lives. And Social Security, it would seem to me, to be best left to families. That's something up to you. Why would you turn to government to provide your pensions in old age? The National Health Service, I can't imagine government having a role in our health except to degrade it. It seems to me that government is a necessary evil, and the fewer things that we grant to its purview, the better. As to vouchers, that, of course, didn't come up in my time. There was no public school system in my time. I'm often credited with being the father of American public education, and I believe very strongly in it for two reasons. First of all, if you wish to be a nation ignorant and free, you expect something that never has been and never can be in the history of the world. So we need public education to create citizenship. But secondly, public education mingles rich and poor, Jew and Gentile, black and white, male and female, people of all walks of life, in ethnicity, in religious sensibility, in economic class, in region. And by doing so, it creates the conditions of respect and tolerance that a democracy depends upon. So if you mingle people in a public school, they will learn to like each other. And that's very important laboratory for democracy. I would therefore be very skeptical of the idea of vouchers, the privatization of education, because that means the Baptists will educate themselves and the Jews will educate themselves and the Zoroastrians will educate themselves and the rich themselves. And suddenly you fractured what could be a commonwealth into a group of factions.
Sam, good questions. You get good answers, too. 1-800-423-8255. Although it's striking, you sound more like a libertarian Republican than the man saluted at all those Jefferson-Jackson Day Democratic dinners.
Well, it is true that your Democratic Party has strayed pretty severely from my vision. I am a libertarian. I said that government is best which governs least. And I said to Mr. Madison, I own that I am not a friend to energetic government. It is always oppressive. What's happened in the 20th century is that there's been a gigantic move towards Hamiltonian-sized government, almost Hobbesian Leviathan. And Franklin Roosevelt, your president of mid-century, said we will only become a Jeffersonian nation if we adopt Hamiltonian means. Needless to say, I would not have agreed with that.
1-800-423-8255, the Thomas Jefferson Connection. Richard is on the line.
Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Mr. President.
Good morning, Richard.
Hi. You just mentioned that you're a libertarian, and certainly from your day of the Whigs and Federalists and what have you, the two-party system, as we now know, it's evolved into something quite different than I would imagine you as a founder anticipated. What's your view to the health of the two-party system and or where we should take it as two separate parties?
Well, it's a question for you to determine where you should take it. I would not be in favor of a party system whatsoever, although I inadvertently helped to create one. I believe that in a republic we can be nonpartisan, that we can decide scientifically where the bridge should be placed, where the road should go, where the canal should be dug. That these are issues that lend themselves to reason and good sense, and on every issue we don't need to divide into faction A and faction B, which are at each other's throats. And as you know, as a young man, I wrote a famous letter to Edward Carrington saying if I could only go to heaven at the head of a party, I would rather not go at all. But later in life, I realized that parties were probably zoologically inevitable in human affairs and that there would always be the party of the many and the party of the few. I pride myself somewhat in always attaching myself to the party of the many. What strikes me as interesting about your system is that you have really one party divided into two factions, the Greater Hamilton Party and the Lesser Hamilton Party, but there is no genuine alternative that speaks for Jeffersonian values. Therefore, it seems to me that the American people have little to choose from and rightly show apathy rather than interest in elections.
That said, Mr. President, what would be your view to the two seemingly preemptive candidates that are standing for office today?
Anyone in my time who ran around the country beating his breast and talking about his virtues would be considered automatically suspect. In my first term, I said, whenever a man casts his eye longingly on public office, a certain rottenness of character is sure to creep in.
Thank you very much.
Richard, thank you. It's interesting, Thomas Jefferson, that people address you as Mr. President, which is precisely the title that you left off your tombstone.
It's true.
Always puzzled me and many people.
Well, the presidency was not an office that I took much pride in. I was a reluctant president. I called that office splendid misery. But I wouldn't have pointed to any office. An office is a responsibility that you undertake on behalf of your community. You do it because you believe that you must sacrifice your private happiness for the public good. But to point to an office would be ungentlemanly, and to point to that sort of an achievement is ephemera. An achievement worth mentioning on one's tombstone is something that benefits humankind in the broadest sense, something that, in my terms, ameliorates the condition of mankind. I wanted to be remembered for just three things. The Declaration of Independence, of course, 1776. The University of Virginia, which I created in my retirement and which opened in 1825. And finally, the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, which separated church and state in Virginia and set the precedent for that separation for the whole nation. Those are real achievements on behalf of the future of human happiness and human liberty. Whether I was the governor or the postmaster is neither here nor there.
Well, that's interesting. You want to be remembered, in effect, as a writer, a teacher, and a theorist of freedom?
Correct.
Were you going out of your way to, as we would say, diss the presidency?
No.
Were you making a statement?
No, I wasn't. But I was showing that the presidency is subordinate to other achievements. If I had never been the president of the United States, the world would be more or less the same. But if I had not written the Declaration of Independence, that's another question.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Thomas Jefferson connection. Angelo is on the line.
Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Angelo. Welcome.
And Mr. President.
Good morning.
First of all, to Mr. Jenkins there, I'm not a believer in reincarnation, but you don't happen to be 5'10 and have red hair, do you?
I would have to be 6'2 and a half to be the actual size of myself in my own time.
I see. That was it. Okay, my questions. Is it true that a friend of yours, a doctor, Philip Matsay, a doctor and horticulturalist, who had written some articles in the Virginia Gazette, is accredited to having written or referred to in your declaration that all men are created equal? Is it true that...
A lifted line, you mean?
Dr. Matsay wrote those statements?
No, it is not true. Matsay was a friend of mine, and of course he started the first vineyard in Virginia next to Monticello on land that I provided for him, and he was an ardent patriot. In fact, went off to Italy, his own country, to solicit funds and support for our revolution, but he didn't contribute anything to that document at all. I'll tell you who did, however. The ideas come largely from John Locke's Second Treatise on Government, and the actual phraseology of the Declaration of Independence owes a great deal to another great patriot, George Mason. Mason wrote the Virginia Declaration of Rights just a few weeks before I drafted the Declaration of Independence.
I see.
If you study those two documents, you'll find a great deal of echoing.
I understand in some preserved copies of the Virginia Gazette there are some articles by Matsay who wrote those very words. Second question is to the Declaration itself. Your words, nature and nature's God, are those philosophically or theologically, would they be deistic or theistic statements?
It's deism, I'm afraid. I used some theistic statements more or less as a public relations matter because I was not writing for myself, but of course for the entire Congress. But I'm essentially a deist. I believe that the world is so orderly and beautiful, so perfect in its Newtonian mechanics, that there is obviously design here, and where there is design, there is a designer. So I'm a deist, and I believe that nature and nature's God are deistic references, but they're also intended to salve the urgency of true Christians, too.
And my last question is, how could you correlate the Declaration with the Emancipation Declaration. You weren't around at the time of the Emancipation Declaration. How do you correlate the two?
Well, I wasn't around. I died in 1826 on the 4th of July. I'm merely reflecting from a kind of indefinite retrospective on what came of American history. And Abraham Lincoln said in private correspondence that if the phrase "all men are created equal" means anything, then it must mean everything. And it was important in the mid-19th century to read that sentence in the most universalist way in order to save the country. So I'm merely responding to what I take to be his own interpretation of my document.
When you speak of slavery, are you getting right with history in hindsight, or were these your views all along that for one reason or another politically you couldn't express?
No, my views have never changed. I'm against slavery. I consider it to be an evil, and I also believe that it's a fundamental violation of the rights of man. I'm not one of those Southerners who argued that slavery is a positive good. Nothing in my 65 volumes of writings could be construed to defend slavery in any way. However, I'm a hypocrite. There's no question. I said all men are created equal, and then I owned some 200 of them. I bought and sold slaves in the course of my lifetime. If the rumors are true, I had sexual congress with at least one of my slaves. I'm a man who was able to speak purely in rhetorical terms, but found it very difficult to act. Part of this was political circumstance. I could not successfully have carried the day on this question, even if I had been less.
Do you care to be, after the break, maybe somebody will cross-examine you on the sexual congress and the famous Sally Hemings. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Thomas Jefferson Connection with the scholar Clay Jenkinson, who does Thomas Jefferson on public radio and knows the man's mind as well as anybody. He's taking your questions about his America and ours at 1-800-423-8255. Interactive radio is something you didn't experience. You're famous for an observation you'd sooner see a nation with no government and lively newspapers than lively government and no newspapers. What do you make of our 21st century media? How free, how political, how useful, including the electronics?
You have the freest newspapers in human history. You are now in a position to know what they're is to know about government. Average citizens can follow legislation moment by moment and intervene at key moments in the passage of legislation. These are miracles that any one of my time would have considered an impossibility in human nature or in technology. So you're fortunate. Now, most citizens don't take advantage of that dissemination of information, but that's another question entirely. Whether your newspapers and other media are responsible is another question. You know, they've never been particularly responsible. In my time, all newspapers were partisan rags. There was no differentiation between editorializing and news. There was no illusion of objectivity. And I was the victim of this. In fact, in 1807, I wrote to my friend John Norville at the end of my second term as president and said I would never censor newspapers or prosecute them, certainly not at the national level, but I do hope that hereafter all newspaper editors will divide their papers into four sections: truth, probabilities, possibilities, and bald lies.
Good luck. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Thomas Jefferson. Mizrak is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Mizrak.
Hi. Mr. Jefferson, I have two questions. What was your vision on U.S. relation with Africa 200 years ago, and how about on the 21st century? That's the first question. And second one is, when you say man is created equal, what do you think about women? Do you think they are equal also?
Interesting question. Let me start with Africa. I hoped that we would stop the slave trade, and I was the first to ever advocate that in the United States. In fact, while I was president, I urged Congress to abolish the slave trade, and Congress did. We became the first nation in the history of the world to abolish that odious practice of kidnapping black Africans. Now, I will tell you this. This is controversial, and keep in mind that I'm speaking as an 18th century man. I believe that nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that we must free all of our slaves. But I also believe that we could not be a biracial society, and I urge that we repatriate freed slaves in their native Africa. I was accordingly one of the first subscribers to the repatriation societies of Sierra Leone and Liberia, and I believe, frankly, that our slaves, even though they had been maliciously treated here, would carry back with them the shreds of our own system, and they would liberate the continent of Africa for the purposes of enlightenment and self-government. So I have complicated and not altogether admirable views on the mingling of the races and so on in the 20th century. In the 21st, I leave it to you to determine what your foreign policy should be, but I would say some reparations are almost certainly in order. I'm an isolationist in my own time and place and believe the United States should mind its own business. As to women, I believe they're fully equal. They're our companions in life. They're intellectually engaging. They are our partners in many important respects. I did not in my own time believe that women should vote or hold public office, and I famously said the tender breasts of ladies were not formed for political convulsion.
Ms. Jack, do you want to respond?
It's very interesting. Oh, it's a different way of thinking. He's so behind on women issue. I mean, that was his time, so it's different generation now. And I appreciate the answer.
Well, madam, that's fine, and I certainly believe we can disagree as rational friends, but keep in mind that women in my time had no birth control, that they were almost continuously pregnant, that the miscarriage rate in Virginia was about a third, and most women died in their 30s from complications of birthing their children. There was no obstetrics, no hygiene, no antisepsis. There was no gynecology of any sort. Women in my time lived in a very primitive age in which they were tied much more completely to their biology than any woman in the first world is in your era.
Ms. Rack, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Alan is on the line.
Hi. I was wondering what you thought of Aaron Burr.
Well, he was my vice president for my first term. The problem is that I could not be president without winning the state of New York, and New York could not be had without making an accommodation with Colonel Burr. I never trusted him. He was a man of great evil and ambition, and, of course, he went on to kill Hamilton in a duel. I consider dueling to be barbarism. And then he went off to the Southwest, the Ohio Valley and below, and tried to, apparently, to commit treason against the United States by creating his own little Napoleonic empire. He wrote to his daughter Theodosia and said, "I will make you Empress of Mexico by Christmas." At that point, we had to stop him. I had him arrested. We tried him for treason. Unfortunately, the presiding judge in that trial was my odious cousin John Marshall, who acquitted Burr, even though he was obviously guilty.
Alan?
All right. I was wondering, because you don't seem like you like Hamilton all that much.
No, I must tell you, for a moment, I wish that they had both fired accurately in the duel, but it is true that Hamilton, however much I disliked him, was a man of character, and he could be trusted to behave like a gentleman, and I would rather have a gentleman whose policies I disagreed with than Burr, who was sympathetic in politics, but was a man of such viciousness of character that he could never be counted on.
You know, this is fascinating that you say we're condemned to live now in a Hamiltonian economy, in a Hamiltonian state. We revere you. Very few people have strong feelings about the great New Yorker, Alexander Hamilton. What was it you didn't like about him? And what should we, how's to caution us about, or educate us about, the Hamilton legacy?
This could be an endless discussion. Let me try to keep it very simple. There are two issues. One is policy, and one is Mr. Hamilton's view of democracy. His policy was that we needed to be a military, industrial, capitalist, banking, centralized state, essentially what you are. I think that, frankly, is a squandering of the potential of the American Revolution. Thomas Paine famously said in his pamphlet Common Sense, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again." The United States, separated from the havoc of the old world by a moat of 3,000 miles, had it in its power to create the world's first utopian society. And instead, men like Hamilton, who read the Revolution negatively and conservatively, wanted simply to ape the discredited habits of the old world. So my chief concern about Mr. Hamilton is that his policies were old world policies, and they created class divisions and produced urban industrial circumstances, which are the parent of misery. That's my fundamental concern. I also have a concern about his anthropology. Your politics is dependent upon your view of human nature. And Hamilton believed that man is evil, that man is a scoundrel, and he said in his famous address to the Constitutional Convention on the 18th of June, 1787, that we should have a president to serve for life, senators to serve for life, that the president should have absolute veto powers over the legislative branches, that the national government should have veto powers over the states, and he said, let us reduce the states to mere administrative units, which is precisely, of course, what has happened. And Hamilton believed, frankly, to his core, that man is not capable of governing himself. I began our interview by saying my deepest conviction is that man is capable, under careful circumstances, of governing himself. So here is a fundamental divide.
How is it that you're so infinitely more famous than the man who you say sort of won the battle?
Well, I have a beautiful home, one of the world's most beautiful private dwellings. I was the father of American viticulture, so all wine lovers know of me. I created the Library of Congress and endowed it with its Universalist collection in 1815. I wrote learnedly and, some say, delightfully on almost every subject. I was a Renaissance man, and Hamilton was not. He was what you would call a policy wonk. And once you take his national bank out of the picture, what's left of Hamilton? You know, I'm the man who gave you the spirit of America. I promise you that no other one of the founding fathers, even John Adams, my friend, could have written all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these is the pursuit of happiness. I'm the dreamer, the optimist, the lover of the American spirit, and there is nobody in American history who spoke for the aspirations of humankind as clearly and forcefully as I did. That's the difference between me and all of the rest, and it's largely rhetorical.
Could we have done it your way?
Yes, you still can. It's going to require bloody revolution now, but you could have done it my way. You should have done it my way, in my opinion.
What would we have to do today?
You would have to quit your work and take up a small farm in western Massachusetts. You'd have to grow a tomato and a cabbage. You would have to become much more self-sufficient. You would probably need to learn Greek. You would need to distinguish yourself from the addictions that you have created that make you dependent upon institutions that you cannot control. You would need to educate yourselves much more thoroughly than you do. You'd need to adhere to the Tenth Amendment, which clearly says those powers not delegated to the national government belong instead to the states and to the people. You can still do this, but of course it's too late to do it easily. You now would have to do something like a French Revolution, where blood would roll in the streets and there would be redistribution of property and tearing down of institutions. Think how much easier this was when the West was a public domain, an empty quarter, what John Locke called a tabula rasa, on which we could inscribe any form of system we could dream of.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Thomas Jefferson connection with Clay Jenkinson. Dwayne is calling from Crestwood, Kentucky.
Hi.
Hello, Dwayne.
Mr. President.
Good day, citizen.
It's an honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
My question is a follow-on to the discussion that you've just been having, and it centers on the 1798 resolutions, which I presume that you wrote in Kentucky. We're unclear about whether you wrote them all and whether John Breckinridge actually helped write them or not. I'd be interested in your comment on that, but more especially, the 1798 resolutions were probably the seminal statement of states' rights in the country at that time. In fact, we actually passed them here formally in Kentucky. And what I'm interested in is how must you have felt later during the time when you were considering the Louisiana Purchase, since that would seem to have gone against all of the principles that you would have been enunciating in the 1798 resolutions with respect to the limited authority of the federal government and the supremacy of the states?
That's a complicated question. Let me give a simple answer. I did write the Kentucky resolutions. I wrote them secretly. I didn't dare attach my name to them because I was the vice president for John Adams, and the vice president should not be writing seditious documents while serving in that capacity, and I didn't want to be disloyal to my friend Adams either. So I wrote them secretly. John Breckinridge carried them back to Kentucky. He did introduce them there. They were passed. They are, in a sense, the locus classicus, the founding statement of the doctrine of nullification. When I became president, of course, I wanted to secure this country's liberty for the future. I sent ministers to France to buy New Orleans, which is entirely constitutional, and Napoleon, in the most foolish counteroffer in human history, offered not New Orleans for $6 million, but all of the interior of the continent for $15.6 million. I doubled the size of the United States for 3 cents per acre. It was the greatest land sale in human history, and it was the making moment of American destiny. But you are correct. It was technically unconstitutional, and that produced some squirming in my administration. But it would have been treason against the future of liberty not to make the purchase.
Dwayne, do you want to follow up?
No, that's wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dwayne. 1-800-423-8255. Sean is calling from Blackfoot, Idaho.
Yes, good morning, Mr. President.
Good day, citizen.
Yes, I know that you were a man who was very in favor of industrial hemp, and in fact, you smuggled in seeds from France on more than one occasion, and you did write that hemp is of the utmost importance to the prosperity and safety of the United States. Well, I was wondering what your opinions and feelings are of the prohibition of industrial hemp today.
Well, first of all, let me correct the record slightly. I didn't bring hemp into this country. There was plenty of it already here. I grew hemp at Poplar Forest and at Monticello, and I'm a great advocate. It's great for sailcloth. The word canvas comes from cannabis. There is a very distinguished tradition of hemp growing for fibers and for forage, and I'm greatly in favor of it and would be against any form of government that would stop you from growing whatever you please on your own private property. But the crop that I smuggled in from Europe was rice. It was a form of Piedmont rice that was growing in Lombardy, and I couldn't take it out of the country legally because there was an industrial prohibition on the export of that rice in its unprocessed form. I don't believe in such prohibition, so I simply smuggled a bag or two of it with me when I crossed the Alps. If your question is about the growing of hemp as a purely industrial product, I'm certainly for it. Needless to say, I must tell you, I was never intoxicated in the whole course of my life, not by any substance whatsoever. It was, after all, the age of reason.
You didn't inhale.
Nor did I smoke.
But surely you drank some of that wine you...
I drank Bordeaux. I drank the finest wine I could afford, 2 glasses per day.
Interesting. 1-800-423-8255, the Thomas Jefferson Connection. Amanda is on the line.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Hello, Amanda.
I'm calling from Massachusetts, one of the oldest states in the nation, proudly. But my question is regarding your comments on all men created equal, but I think you're failing to neglect the huge genocide of the American Indian and how their rights were stripped, their spirituality, their homes, constantly moved around the country. How could you say that all men are created equal when this mass murder was committed in your backyard?
Well, madam, I hope you won't hold me responsible for the sins of American history. And by the way, it's the first time I've ever been called a guy. But let me say that I am in favor of Indian rights. When I bought Louisiana, I said, we do not buy that territory in fee simple. We only buy the first right of negotiation with the Aboriginal sovereign. And in my second inaugural address, which I invite you to take a look at, I gave the longest single presidential statement on Indian rights. And among other things, I said, these people deserve our commiseration. After all, they only wanted to be left undisturbed. And if you go to my book, Notes on Virginia, my only published book, 1785, you will find in it Logan's speech, the greatest oration in human history, better than Demosthenes, better than Cicero, better than Patrick Henry. It's by an Indian named Logan. And I consider Indians to be the most extraordinary beings on the continent and believe we have more to learn from them than they do from us. It was Andrew Jackson, my successor, who put in motion the great policies that led to the genocide of Indian peoples in the mid-19th century.
Hmm. Amanda? You must have satisfied her. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Jefferson connection. Chester is calling from Warwick, Rhode Island.
Hello, Mr. Jenkinson.
Good day.
And my comment is, I think that the separation of church and state should be credited to Roger Williams in Rhode Island.
Yes, I believe he played a very important role in the colonial period of this. The phrase, wall of separation between church and state, is my own, and I wrote it in a letter of early 1803 to the Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut. But yes, there's a distinguished tradition that goes back to Williams and beyond.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted you to clarify that. Also, were you, as Tom Jefferson, aware that Rhode Island on July 8, 1663, called the Rhode Island Charter, received permission from King Charles II to govern ourselves?
Yes, I was. You know, John Adams, the great, great Massachusetts legislator and visionary, said that the Revolution was won 10 years before the Stamp Act crisis, because the American people had already, in their hearts and habits and in their ways and means, established their independence. We had been left to our own devices by a faraway island crown in Britain, and the American people had already been independent before the first shot was fired. That is certainly the case, and I'm not a great fan of New England, I must say. I don't like New England Puritanism. I don't like Calvinism in any of its forms. But I will say this much, that New England is the parent of American democracy, and New England's greatest single contribution to the world is the New England town meeting.
Take that, New England. 1-800-423-8255. The connection with Thomas Jefferson. Pat is calling from a car phone.
Hello, Mr. Jefferson.
Hello, citizen.
I had a question for you. I've heard that it was you who was responsible for the foundation of the original Marine Corps band, that as a music lover you heard the fife and drum music that was played during the Revolution and had fifers and drummers play in the White House for state events. Is that true?
It is true. The Marine Corps is one of my inventions, although there were Marine Corps elsewhere, but I sent the Marines off to North Africa to fight the barbarians of Tripoli in Algeria during my day. This is the Barbary War, from which you get the phrase the shores of Tripoli. But I also used the Marine Corps Band as my official orchestra for my very modest White House. I served from 1801 to 1809, and it's true that I opened the White House twice a year for public gatherings, the 1st of January, of course, and our nation's birthday, the 4th of July. And on both of those occasions, the Marine Corps Band provided the entertainment. I cannot live without music. It's the favorite passion of my soul.
1-800-423-8255. Keith is calling from Tiverton, Rhode Island.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Yes, I'd just like to say I share Mr. Jefferson's love of the music of Handel, Haydn, and Vivaldi.
Good.
Yes.
Corelli, too, please.
I'm sorry, sir?
Corelli,
absolutely.
Yes.
I'd like to say, you made a very famous remark once of how the Tree of Liberty must from time to time be watered with the blood of tyrants and patriots. I believe those were your words. I'm just wondering, after 200 years of paying what I believe to be lip service to the Constitution, perhaps it's time for another revolution in light of how big the government has become, what with the CIA, the FBI. I'm sure you're aware of those agencies.
Yes, well, it is the tendency of things for government to gain ground and liberty to yield, and I do think we should tear up the Constitution once per generation so the government doesn't sink too deep a root. But I am a supporter of bloody revolution, too. I never renounce bloodshed. And when Lafayette, the great French patriot, wrote to me lamenting the terror in France, I said, my friend, did you expect to be transported from despotism to liberty on a feather bed? Now, whether it's time for you to have a revolution, I leave to you to determine. But I would never, ever rule one out.
Keith, you want to follow?
I'm sorry, sir?
Did you want to follow up?
No, I think he answered my question very well.
Keith, thank you.
Thank you.
Ron, you're the last caller.
Hi, good morning, Mr. President. How are you, sir?
Good morning.
Hi. I'm sure that you're aware that at the present time there's a question that's being hotly debated in our country, and that's the interpretation of the Second Amendment, the right of a free citizen to keep and bear arms. Now, there are some people who believe that that is a collective right when you wrote about the militia being necessary for a secure state. There are others who believe that it is an individual right. Would you tell us exactly what you meant when you wrote that amendment, sir?
I didn't write it, I must say. It was Mr. Madison who wrote it. I can't speak for him, but I will tell you this. There is both a collective and an individual right, and among other things, you must have guns in your house, sir, so that if necessary, you can bring down your government with violence. Government must never, in my opinion, have a monopoly on the uses of force. A free man is a man with a gun.
Ron, thank you for the question. I'm not sure I want to thank you for the answer, Thomas Jefferson, but we'll take it. Last thing, you mentioned Logan, the Indian orator, greater than Demosthenes, you say. Where do we find Logan's speech?
Now, you can find that speech in my only book, Notes on the State of Virginia. You can find it on your World Wide Web. Let me also give you a website, th-jefferson.org. If you write to me, I will gladly send you that information. And I should quickly say that I'll be appearing a number of times in Boston this week. If you're interested,
yeah,
call the Boston
I was
Public Library.
Tell folks, Wednesday evening, Thursday evening, this week at the Boston Public Library, Clay Jenkinson will be doing Thomas Jefferson. call the Boston Public Library. It's Wednesday evening, Thursday afternoon. More details at the library. Thanks for help today from John Hoder, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The Connection's produced by all sorts of good Jeffersonian and Hamiltonian people. Mary McGrath is our Jefferson. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Fornova, enabling dynamic B2B trading networks, now hiring internet professionals on the web at fornova.com. My Battery March Conference Center providing picnic lunches for